Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It was not a great launch for a new message. On the very day that President George Bush hits the road with a revised campaign for his war in Iraq, 8 Iraqi policemen are killed by a suicide bomber. Dozens are wounded. A Spanish diplomat is chased through the streets of Baghdad and shot. And later, 2 more American soldiers are killed in an ambush.
Life is getting better. It's a lot better than you probably think. Just ask people who've been there. They're stunned when they come back, when they go to Iraq, and the stories they tell are much different from the perceptions that you're being told life is like. You see, we're providing this help not only because we've got good hearts, but because our vision is clear. A stable and democratic and hopeful Iraq will no longer be a breeding ground for terror, tyranny, and aggression.
President George Bush speaking yesterday at a major speech in New Hampshire. Bush now says that Iraq is the central front in the war on terror and that America will stay and not run from that challenge. But Bush has other problems. The credibility of his administration has been called into question in the way that the march to war was built on the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Congress is snarling about the $87 billion. Democrats say they want more answers. Bush and Cheney say they're in control. Connection listeners, what do you make of the administration's decision to go on the offensive, to make its case on Iraq? Are you buying the message that the war was justified, is justified, and that the U.S. needs to stay and pay until the job is done? Beyond that, what happens to the Bush doctrine of preemption if the administration is unable to persuade its critics? Joining us today, former chief diplomatic correspondent for CBS and NBC News, Marvin Kalb. Marvin is currently a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's JFK School. And he's joining us from National Public Radio in Washington. Marvin, nice to have you back in the program.
Hi, good morning, Dick.
Howard Lepanke is also with us. Howard is diplomatic affairs reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's joining us from the Monitor's Washington Bureau. Hi, Howard.
Morning, Dick.
Howard, can I start with you? Tell me what you're hearing as the essence of this new message.
Well, I think what we're seeing is trying to correct a downhill slide that began actually back when the president gave his speech, primetime speech to the American public, when he said that he would be going for the $87 billion for Iraq next year. That speech didn't go over well, as even the White House acknowledges, and immediately poll numbers showed support among the American public starting to slide. Now we're seeing a public relations campaign, and just today, the vice president was sent out. He spoke this morning here in Washington, and I think there's a strong feeling that when the vice president is called out, as he periodically is for Sunday morning shows and a speech once in a while, but he remains mostly hidden away. And when he is called out, it's a sign that the administration is deeply concerned about how its efforts are being perceived by the public.
We actually have a little bit of Mr. Cheney's speech. He was speaking about a half an hour ago at the Heritage Foundation in Washington and speaking very specifically about exactly what the message is in this new PR offensive.
We are applying the Bush Doctrine. Any person or government that supports, protects, or harbors terrorists is complicit in the murder of the innocent and will be held to account.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you in on our conversation. Marvin Kalb, I hear in what the vice president is saying an echo of a line that I heard a long time ago. It's the "if you are not with us, you're against us" line.
Yeah, well, that grew out of the 9/11 attacks. And up to that point, I think it's commonly understood here in Washington that George W. Bush was an okay president, but he certainly did not have clear lines defining something new. But then 9/11 happened, and then this president took on a crusade, as he himself has pointed out, and as the vice president has now called the Bush Doctrine. And this lays out something in a sense that is very clear, very, very large, very dangerous, very difficult. And yet it is being sold to the American people not as a transforming change in American approach, developing a preemptive strategy, but as something that sort of just flows. We're going to do it. We're America. It's going to happen. But it's not that easy. And I think the numbers that Howard talked about a moment ago reflect this deep, growing uneasiness on the part, not just of the American people, but of the people who make policy in this city. They're not sure it's working right. And they're trying to reestablish with the American people a bond that says, believe us, because Bush believes in this doctrine, it's going to go okay.
I don't think it's at all just coincidence that in his speech this morning, the vice president really tried to elevate what the United States is doing in Iraq to very high historic levels. He spoke. Yes. He compared this to the Cold War. He said that, you know, this is the next big battle, and he talked about a stark and clear historic choice, and the one that America has to make, that America has risen to in the past, and that, of course, this president, as he said, is presenting America with that choice, in a sense saying the president knows where he wants to go. Is America going to be with him?
It's an interesting thing, too, Howard, that Condi Rice, the national security advisor, has often spoken of this moment in history as a tipping point moment, where it can go from one whole strategy to another. And that is, in effect, what Cheney is trying to say, what the president is now trying to say. And by the way, they've been trying to say this now since 9/11, that the Cold War ended 10, 12 years ago, and we are in a new global struggle. But what is so different about this one is it's so hard to sell because there isn't a clear enemy. We've always associated enemies with states, with particular personalities. And this one seems larger than Osama bin Laden. And we don't quite know how to handle it. We're not ready for this new kind of challenge, perhaps.
Let's just listen a little more to the way that the president is characterizing it, and very much along the lines that you're describing it, Marvin.
You become the president, you can't predict all the challenges that will come. But you do know the principles you bring to office. And they should not change. They shouldn't change with time. And they shouldn't change with polls. I took this office to make a difference, not to mark time. I came to this office to confront problems directly and forcefully, not to pass them on to future presidents and future generations.
That's the president speaking in his major address yesterday in New Hampshire. And Howard, whenever I hear a president say that he's not paying attention to the polls, I always pause and wonder if he's saying that precisely because he is paying attention to polls.
Well, yes, I think there's no question that there is deep concern. I think there's a feeling in the White House, Congress, in a sense, Congress they can handle. Although they were certainly worried there for a few days when even Republicans were talking about making the Iraqis pay back what we would front in the beginning in terms of support. But when they see support sliding seriously among the American public, that's when certainly the antenna go up. And and if anything, this certainly, this is the way the president put his comments, if anything, is a campaign speech talking about why he came to the presidency. That certainly sounded like it.
You know what I find very interesting, too? The president, not just today, he has said this a couple of times in the past, too, but he says he wants to take on problems frontally and not pass them on to future generations and future presidents. One could argue, and I have no idea if this is sound reasoning at all, but one could argue that what he might be saying indirectly there is that his father made a mistake 12 years ago in allowing Saddam Hussein to remain in power after the Persian Gulf War. It was clearly within America's military grasp to get rid of him at that time. But then President Bush decided not to for a whole variety of reasons. And this president is saying, no, I'm not going to allow a serious problem to be passed on to another generation of leaders. And we ought not to forget also that this president is a first-class campaigner, and he is getting ready for next year. He is aware that there is an election coming up, and he does not want Iraq to be an albatross around him and his administration. He wants somehow to persuade the American people that they're engaged in something very large, very worthy, and definitely he is the man to lead the charge.
Okay, but Marvin, when the message changes, as it appears to be, when all the president's men and women head out across the country with their talking points, tell me what you're hearing is the essence of the change here, because we have heard the president's defense of going in to attack Iraq, whether there were weapons of mass destruction there or not. We've heard him talk about it as a way of protecting America. We've heard him talk about it in the preemptive terms that we were mentioning earlier. So how are you seeing or hearing it being fine-tuned just this week?
Well, they're seeking, first of all, to try to stop the erosion of popular support and congressional support. Because right now, what people are focusing on in Washington, if you pick up the Washington Post this morning, for example, is the infighting going on within the administration, not the policy itself. A wonderful columnist in the Washington Post leads his column today by saying, it's Iraq, stupid. And what he's trying to say there is that there is so much infighting, so much debate now about $87 billion or no $87 billion, that everyone, including the administration, seems to be losing sight of the central issue here, and that is to put Iraq somehow back together again.
Howard LaFranchi, it does seem quite unusual, as Marvin points out, to hear and read about tiffs between Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld in the newspapers, to read in journals like the Weekly Standard criticism of Rumsfeld and suggestions that there's even a civil war going on there. Is this something that we haven't seen yet with this administration?
Well, I think that's the point, yes, that with this administration, this is something new. Of course, we've heard ever since 9/11, at least, of smoldering rivalry between the visions of the Pentagon and the State Department. That is not new. But for the disagreements to come out so publicly as they have this week, I think that is alarming, actually, to the president, even. And you start to hear that inside the White House that this president, who is not at all opposed to debate within the White House, and who seems to like to listen to different sides and then come through very confidently, as I think he is in his own judgment, but come through and say, okay, this is the side I come down on, and that's when the debate ends. I think the president is not at all happy that this is come out as publicly as it has.
Howard, let me stop you there, because I just want to give our number 1-800-423-8255 and a question for Connection listeners. The message you're hearing now from the Bush administration on the war in Iraq, how are you seeing it change, and is it making sense to you? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me this hour, Marvin Kalb, Senior Fellow at the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Howard LaFranchi, Diplomatic Affairs Reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And Connection listeners, you are also with us as we take stock of the new message coming from the White House, coming in the same week that there are signs of serious dissent from within the offices there, also coming at a time when there is growing opposition to the message that the president and his team are trying to put out. And that opposition is being heard more and more.
They did not find the imminence of a threat. And no matter how they paint it, they cannot show the imminence of a threat. We had time to use our good offices as a country, our moral suasion, our diplomacy, to try to build international support and international pressure on Saddam Hussein, and if necessary to go to war, to do so in a true coalition of countries that would not only share the risk with us, but share the responsibility of post-war Iraq. So their characterization of Dr. K's report, in my view, is lame.
We've been led into this situation, in my view, by a cadre of political scientist romantics with a political naivete. And we've been led into it, in my view, by selective manipulation of intelligence that has many of us, unfortunately, once again, wondering whether we can believe the pronouncements of our own government. I've been there before, under Lyndon Johnson and LBJ in Vietnam, and under Richard Nixon in Watergate. I don't like being here again.
Well, no secret there. You're listening to Democratic lawmakers commenting on the Bush administration's current position with its war in Iraq. The last voice we heard was that of Wisconsin Congressman David Obey. Before that, Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi. And Marvin, when David Obey starts talking about the measure of, I guess, the lack of credibility in administration and measuring it against Watergate and Vietnam, that's invoking some pretty powerful spirits.
Very, very powerful indeed. And it is suggestive of the beginning of the kind of national debate about Iraq that perhaps the nation should have had before the actual war began. But let's remember that a year ago, the Congress voted to give the president full power to follow through on what he believed was right in Iraq. The Congress did not want to take on the president. The policy seemed enveloped in such a rich patriotism that nobody wanted to counter that view. Nobody wanted to be associated with what might seem in some political minds as an unpatriotic questioning of the president's beliefs. And so everything kind of went along, and the press allowed it to go along, right through the whole build-up to the war and the war itself. Only when circumstances changed, that is, when we got into the post-war Iraq situation and we suddenly found, whoops, we don't have a policy for this, that people began to say, maybe something huge has gone wrong. Those are the deep kind of questions that are now being asked that frighten the administration, which faces an election and which does not want to be challenged on something that the president, deep down, I believe, in his gut, believes is right, that he did the right thing. And Lyndon Johnson used to say the same things about Vietnam. Nixon also about Vietnam. So Reagan used to say the same things about the evil empire. In other words, presidents generally focus on a single issue, and they truly believe they're right. And why can't the press support me? And why can't the people support me? I'm right. And I think that President Bush is pretty much in that position right now.
And Howard, when
Dick,
you,
I think
yeah,
it's
go ahead.
Important. yeah, Dick, I think it's important to say that I think what we're seeing happen here this week is the administration, a full court press effort to put this effort in Iraq back squarely in the context of the war on terror. I think the administration realizes that if the debate continues over money and democracy or no in an Arab country and some of the minutiae, that their battle may be lost. They want this in the context of what the president has said is his big theme for his presidency. That is the war on terror, and that's why we're seeing all this comparison to the Cold War. Another very sort of esoteric arguments, because if this sort of degenerates into just discussions of money and whether or not it was right or not to take out a dictator and that kind of thing, then the going into the election, the administration is going to be in a losing position.
And I think this was very clear in yesterday's speech when you heard the president say this is a new kind of war. America's following a new strategy, not waiting for further attacks. We're striking our enemies before they can strike us again.
The regime of Saddam Hussein possessed and used weapons of mass destruction, sponsored terrorist groups, and inflicted terror on its own people. Nearly every nation recognized and denounced this threat for over a decade.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Buffalo, New York, and Robert's calling in. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, I do have a different opinion. After about 30 minutes of a one-sided bush bash, there's almost too many points to say, but I think it's really...
Why do you call it a one-sided bush bash if what we're doing is trying to figure out how he's changing the message? I mean, it was the White House itself that announced they were changing the message, Robert.
Well,
it's not something I cooked up.
I think that's kind of a false assumption, trying to change the message. I think the message is essentially the same. The denotation
right.
is pretty much unchanged. We have a function to do there. We have, as a world power, we have a reason to be there, and we have a good moral obligation to do so. The connotation, I think, is really more political because of the hard time the press and liberals are giving him, because they just don't like Bush and they don't like a Republican in there, that they're trying to make attempts at a teapot. It seems the liberal press is against anything any Republican does anytime, and you folks have just spent time characterizing Vietnam and Johnson and Nixon and so forth, not giving a poor guy a chance. But we are Americans. This is our country. He's our president. And if I may just get to this real quick, about the $87 billion, we give $10 billion alone just to Israel every year. So $87 billion is not very much money at all. So to keep bringing it up is really disingenuous.
But,
well, Robert, that's an interesting point of view, but perhaps you just disagree with polls that have come out. But a number of polls show a declining support from the American public and deep concerns about the $87 billion. So,
that shows that the propaganda of the media is working, because they're getting a one-sided story predominantly. And $87 billion is nothing in this country, nothing. It really is. If we can give $10 billion to Israel, $5 billion Pakistan, what's $87 billion? It's nothing. It's nothing in this country.
So what's the part of the story that you think's not being told, Robert?
Well, that there is an evil empire there, if you will. Saddam Hussein was not good for the world. He's protecting Bush is protecting Israel by getting rid of this threat, and I think we're doing a service to Israel this way. And, someone has to do something. As I said, the UN had 10 years of resolution that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, and no one did anything about it. There takes a man sometimes to step up to the plate and take things, do things. Of course, it's a distasteful job, but someone has to do it. And Bush is the one to do it, and he's getting grief for it.
Marvin, let me hear from you here.
Well, when Robert speaks about a tempest in a teapot and Iraq being the tempest in a teapot, I don't understand his use of language, frankly. When Americans are being killed every day in Iraq, that is hardly a tempest in a teapot. This is a very serious problem, a huge problem facing the country today.
No.
Many, many people in this city who are supporters of the president, let me stress that again, who are supporters of the president, believe we're getting, quote, stuck. And they are the ones who raise the issue of a Vietnam-type quagmire. I myself do not believe that, but that's irrelevant. What is relevant is that people who are Republicans, people on the Hill, who have supported the president up to this time, are beginning to turn. Now, you have to ask the question, if you want to stay relevant in the world, you have to ask the question, why are Republicans turning against their president? The answer to that is partly the $87 billion that Howard talked to us about before. But the real answer is, are we doing the right thing? And here, the argument that the administration is setting forth, once again going back to original principle, the fight against terrorism, beating up on Saddam Hussein and getting rid of him, raise questions because there's an inconsistency that is so obvious. What about North Korea and its nuclear weapons? What about Iraq? What about Iran, which is more further along in nuclear weapons than Iraq was? These are the issues, Robert.
Robert, I want to thank you very much for calling in. Our number, 1-800-423-8255, next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Greg's joining us. Hi, Greg.
How are you today?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Listen, I tell you, when I go to the barbershop, I'll listen to the, you know, you can get more information and find more, learn more about politics in a barbershop and a grocery store than you can sometimes anyplace. But people are talking about, you know, the $87 billion and $50 million to study a new zip code system. And I can tell you, people are really kind of angry about this. You're going to build new schools there, new infrastructure, garbage trucks, the whole show. The average American person, say, for example, in Mississippi, who makes $10,000, $15,000 a year, they're angry, and they really don't care that much about what's going on. And per se, they care, but they want really to get their own house cleaned up first, meaning the American public. So the anger is coming from people who say, let's get America straightened out because our economy right now is in bad shape.
Greg, let me interrupt you for a minute. Is this just about figuring out how big the shopping list should be, that if the this $50 million or that $150 million were taken off because those appear to be unnecessary or frivolous expenses, then everybody would be comfortable with what might be a $70 billion bill or a $50 billion bill?
Yeah, you know, if you went back and if you broke it down and they said, listen, we got to trim a little bit of this, they want basically the government to trim a little bit, just like everybody else has had to trim a little bit. But the $87 billion price tag is really too much for Americans to really stomach. Because
I'm going to assume
such a tough time here at home.
You're not calling to have the troops come home. You're not calling to say, put an end to this. We don't want to spend any of the money, are you?
No. But I'll tell you, I would like to see, of course, we all would like to see the troops come home. And if they said, okay, we can do, let's say, $30 billion or whatever, you know, I think Americans could live with that. Some Americans could live with that. But we got to look at what's going on here at home, and especially with people losing jobs. You know, I'm not an isolationist, but I tell you, that hit very hard, that $87 billion.
Greg, thanks for your call. Howard, how precise are the polls here in terms of showing where Bush's support is soft and where it's strong? Is it about the actual dollar amounts?
Well, I think that, first of all, in terms of how precise they are, I think, you know, if it were one poll, that wouldn't be much of a concern. But, of course, over a few weeks and different not only national polls, state polls, when they all show the same trend, that's, of course, when it starts looking like this is really something that is changing in the American public. And again, I think if the White House is sort of going out with its big guns, including the president, and taking it to the higher level, I think that they realize that for the American public, while that was sticker shock, the $87 billion was sticker shock, but if they can explain it in terms that a public that after all still very strongly, actually, and I think Robert would agree with this, but very strongly trusts the president's leadership, and so they're banking on that. And if it can be put back on the plane of America's role in the world for the decade or so to come, then they can win support back. I don't think that they believe that if they go out on the road and start explaining, well, we need $50,000 for per garbage truck, that's not a winning proposition.
But it's interesting, Marvin.
Keep it on the high level. That's where they can win.
Going back to what you were saying, Marvin, earlier about this debate that should have been held months ago before
yes.
the war. That's not the way the system often works, because in this case, it is in fact the details that are before the House and Senate committees that are providing the information for people to start scratching their heads. It's that, as well as the Kaye report and other things that people are looking at, which they didn't, which they either chose or were unable to look at prior to the war.
No, I think you're absolutely right. When you get into the details, as I think Greg was saying, and I think quite rightly, people understand money, particularly if people lose jobs or find it difficult to get jobs or suddenly feel an uneasiness about the economy, which I think probably accurately describes what's going on. It may be that the economy will turn around and that will be wonderful for everybody. But at the moment, that's not the case. And people have to examine what is close at hand. And what is close at hand is economic uncertainty. And the trust that they continue to have in the president seems to be somewhat shaken because things in Iraq are not going as we had been led to believe they would go. We were told, remember, before the war, by none other than the Vice President of the United States, that there would be people in the street with flowers. The American troops would be welcomed. Well, a lot of them were. And for a brief period of time, things looked terrific. But that is not the case today, and I think the American people, and all of the polls reflect this, are responding to what is happening since the end of the war. Not the war itself, but since the end of the war. Where is that post-war policy, the strategy, that now seems not to have been there?
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And let's take a call from Norfolk, Virginia. Eve's with us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think that this is not a monetary issue as much as it is a social issue, and the fact that we went in there. I believe that we needed to go in there. I believe that we needed to help liberate this country. I think the question is, and why people start to get upset about the money, is it means increased responsibility and continued responsibility. And the question is, and the question I have for you is, where does this responsibility end? When do we turn it over to the Iraqis to take responsibility for their country and for helping to rebuild it? Where do we turn it over? I think that the monetary, it's not so much the money, but it's just an idea that we are continuing to be involved.
Connection listeners, a wonderful point from Eve in Norfolk here, that it may not be just about the dollar figure, but whether or not the United States should be accepting responsibility for as much as it is accepting in Iraq, and when that responsibility ends, when things can be handed over to the Iraqis. Certainly that's a point in the argument which is being debated from both sides. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. There has been a bit of a public relations push from the White House this week with the president, the vice president, heading out, making major speeches, as well as Republican congressional representatives. Let's pick this up, if we can, back where Eve left us just before the break. She asked the question, when does the United States pass along responsibility for control of that country to the Iraqis themselves? And Howard, there's a line in the president's speech where he says, our work in Iraq has been long, it's hard, it's not finished, we'll stay the course, we'll complete our job. And beyond Iraq, the war on terror continues. In part, it's the difficulty of trying to get people to focus on something that doesn't really have a conclusion, isn't it?
Well, I think the upshot really of Eve's question is, where is the exit strategy? And that is something that this president said, you know, he would not go into conflicts without a clear goal and what had to be accomplished. His Secretary of State has his own doctrine, the Powell Doctrine, which includes the point of, you know, your exit strategy. How do you get out? But I think it's it also explains why the president has taken to comparing this job in Iraq to the post-World War II job that the United States took on in Germany and Japan. Those countries were not turned from threats to world peace into functioning prosperous democracies overnight. And so that's, I think it's a comparison that the American public can understand and explains why he continues to draw that analogy. But that is also this question of turning over power to the Iraqis is not settled. And one that is part of the debate that's going on within the administration. It's going on within the administration, but also between the U.S. government and our international partners at the United Nations, where there are those who would like to see this going much faster.
Let's move along to another caller. Number's 1-800-423-8255 to Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina. Andy's joining us now. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Going back to the original question.
Yes, sir.
I think that Bush may have changed the tone of his message, but not his real reason. The real reason was primarily ideology. And I don't think that's changed. He wanted to have a real effect in the Middle East. He wanted to correct mistakes he thought maybe in past administrations. But he may be changing the message and the tone, but not the real reason.
And how are you hearing it, Andy? How is it resonating with you?
I feel like the weapons of mass destruction wasn't the real reason. I feel like now that they know they're probably not going to find them, that they need to raise it a little bit, saying, look, we're going there to give these people democracy. We're going to change their lives. But that's just the message. That's not the real reason. And, you know, I was against the war, but I completely agree with us staying and properly rebuilding Iraq. And I believe the you know, the Congress fighting over the $88 billion looks completely political. We should have known from the beginning that we had to spend that money.
So the weapons of mass destruction, the security of America, which was spoken about so much before the war, the fact that's in many ways now been changed to the war in Iraq is part of the war on terror. That's fine. It's not really. We're talking about symptoms here. We're not talking about the real issue.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Marvin Kalb, to what degree does a president and give me a bit of a history look back over there. To what degree does a president have the kind of freedom to say, you know what, things are changing, but the real point of where we are, what we're doing, remains the same?
Well, as I was trying to suggest before, a number of presidents in recent history have had deep beliefs that what they are doing is right and that the American people ought to come on board. They ought to be right and understand that I'm right. This is something that comes almost with the office. You get into that office, you don't want to disappoint people, you want to be reelected, you want to go down in history as a great president. This president now is doing something that is truly historic. He is articulating a preemptive strategy which the United States has never used before in its military history. That is to say, if the president believes that there is an enemy lurking in country X, before that enemy has a chance to hurt us, as enemies did on 9/11, we're going to hurt that group. Now, that group is in a country, so that means you have to hurt the country that the group is in as well. That was Afghanistan. That was the experience there. The line now is that is currently the experience in Iraq. It may prove to be the experience in Iraq, but there was no evidence that it was before. And so you have to find a reason why people will come on board. The weapons of mass destruction was a huge reason. We forget that the Secretary of State went before the UN Security Council in February of this year and laid out a case over an hour and a half, I believe, about these weapons of mass destruction. Now there are Americans, thousands of Americans in Iraq, led by an American who once was an arms inspector himself, and they haven't found anything
that is
significant.
If they can't make the case for a preemption, for the Bush Doctrine,
right,
if the administration is unable to persuade its critics, does the doctrine die, stop like that?
Well, it's unable. Yes, in a way it does. But what I'm trying to say is that the doctrine may have incredibly important significance. What happens is that you have a policy, you lay it out, and in this particular case, everything was done from an administration point of view very well, right through the war. Then suddenly we had won, and it was as if we hadn't thought about what was going to happen next. That is where the problem lies now. That's where people get upset. That's why Eve before raised what I think is a fundamental question. It's not just money. It's why are we there? What is the purpose of it all? The president's explained it, but the American people have not yet grasped it. And I think they haven't grasped it because there hasn't been the kind of debate and discussion perhaps that we're having this morning.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to Buffalo, New York. John's with us. Hi, John.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Oh, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. My reason for calling is that, you know, I tend to not believe people such as Mr. Kalb, who comes in from the liberal perspective. I'm familiar with Mr. Kalb, and there's no disrespect. We all have our, you know, we all believe what we believe. But I would like to just have a small colloquy with him, if I may. Mr. Kalb, in your when it came to doing Kosovo, what were your feelings toward that? Just curious.
What are you driving at, John? I want to try and keep this on the topic here.
See, the thing is, if you really look at Iraq is a much better place without Saddam Hussein. There is more electricity on now than there ever was at any one point in the last 10 years in Iraq.
Wait a second. John, I've been to that country, and I can tell...
Were you there before?
Yeah, you bet I was. I was there in 2001, and everybody had power.
Were you in southern Iraq? I'm not trying to argue with you necessarily, but all I'm trying to say is that in Kosovo, I'm sure Mr. Kalb was for it. And that was a question of NATO leading the United States around by the nose. Now, whether you want to believe that or not, NATO needed our help, and all of a sudden they needed help in their backyard. When we were attacked, okay, it was radical fundamentalist Islam. And there is an old expression that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I guarantee you that the number one enemy of all of these fanatics and the terrorists is the United States. And you cannot argue about anything with Palestine and Israel because Osama bin Laden was a late comer to that party.
You got to get to the point here. I need you to talk about Iraq here, not to go back to 9/11 and sort of generalizations.
Well, since he was so familiar, Mr. Kalb was so familiar with it, I want to know who was the visionary who had all the answers prior to the war being waged. You know, this is a country of 25 million people who are in some manner, way, shape, or form free right now. And I am not going to minimize the losses that we suffer in our military. However, what I will point out is that if you look at the 130,000 targets which we have placed in the entire of Iraq, we are losing perhaps one man a day. And as I said, I'm not diminishing it. But we are trying to keep order in a place where people will hide in buildings trying to kill us.
Okay, John, I'm going to stop you there because I like the point that you're making earlier. It actually is one that the administration has used, that a lot of people come back to when they're talking about the war in Iraq, and that is forget about all the justifications, Marvin, forget about all the rationalizations before or after, that the country is, for better or worse, a better place after the war.
You mean that Iraq is a better place?
Yeah.
Absolutely. If you get rid of Saddam Hussein, I think that was a terrific idea. I've got to say to John, please forgive me, Dick, when he calls me a liberal, you know, in a way that's a source of pride, but I think that's a cheap shot and totally, totally beyond the pale. John hasn't a clue, not a clue as to what I think, not a clue. But the issue in Iraq is, if you want to frame it, is Iraq better without Saddam Hussein? I think you'll get 99% of the American people saying yes, and most of the rest of the world. You still are left with a reality. How do you deal with Iraq right now? How do you transfer power to the Iraqis? Who is going to pay for it? Where is the international authority? Can the president continue to move in a unilateral way? These are fundamental questions, and they have to be addressed.
I want to bring Howard.
I think another basic question, and which goes back to John's comments, is what we are trying to accomplish now in Iraq really linked to the war on terror? I think that remains a question broadly in the minds of the American people, and I think that's why we have the White House this week going out and putting it back in that context. Howard, that's where they want it.
I want you to just elaborate a little bit more, though, on what you were saying earlier in the program about the way that that same message is being heard at the UN, because it sounds in many ways like the Bush administration, if we listen to what the leaders are saying this week, has pretty well given up on the idea of getting its resolution through at the UN. Do you think that's fair?
I'm not sure that they now have the British, our closest allies in Iraq, pressuring us quite forcefully to not give up on the resolution and to continue making that effort. And I think in the administration they realize that there's a large international donors conference coming up in later this month, and they want monetary financial help from other countries, and the resolution would is essential to paving the way for that kind of participation. So I'm not sure that they're quite ready to give up. I think what is important for the administration is they don't want to have to turn over any more of the political control in Iraq in order to get full support in the UN. That's where the crux of the debate is now. Mm-hmm. Just how much political control, how much timetable, how much of a clear role for the UN would have to be accepted in order to get support for that resolution.
Marvin, just a few seconds left. Does that international involvement matter anymore?
Well, it does matter, because in essence what we come back to time and time again in the post-war period is, where is the legitimacy of the operation? And a lot of people around the world feel that the legitimacy comes from a UN resolution. We can argue, we can joke about it, we can kid one another, but that is a fact. The president is now, he goes to the UN, he makes a speech there, he is seeking a resolution, and after a month of effort, we cannot get it. That is an important statement of diplomacy, and the United States has to deal with it. What do we do?
Marvin Kalb, so good to have you with us on the program. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marvin Kalb, Senior Fellow at the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. His new book is called The Media and the War on Terrorism. Howard LaFranchi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Howard is diplomatic affairs reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Connection listeners, we invite you to our forum section of our webpage, theconnection.org, if you like to share some views with other listeners about this. A special thanks to John McCrean in Washington for technical assistance with the program today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.